Item 17, Mr. Chair, is our regular information item to update the board on the status of the implementation of the irrigated lands regulatory program. Elaine Saul of our lead staff person for administration, enrollment, and data management of the irrigated lands regulatory program will make a brief presentation to the board. Angela Schroeder, as well as other staff, are also available to answer specific questions. Elaine?
Good afternoon.
No.
Good afternoon and greetings to the board. As Ken stated, my name is Elaine Saul, and I am an environmental scientist with the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. Today I'll be providing the routine informational update, which is item 17 for the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. During this presentation today, I will be providing an overview on the current status of enrollment, a summary of compliance, which was previously requested by the board, individual groundwater monitoring and reporting status, drinking water notification letters that have been issued, and annual compliance form modifications that have been completed. Enrollment in the agriculture order has seen a steady increase since 2010. Currently, enrollment is at an all-time high, with 99% of the estimated irrigated acreage enrolled in Region 3. The graph on this slide shows this steady increase. In fiscal year 2010 and 2011, estimated irrigated acreage was at 387,000 enrolled. In fiscal year 2012-2013, approximately 430,000 irrigated acres are enrolled in the agricultural order. On a related note, and also as provided in the supplemental sheet to the board, Water Board staff has recommended the termination to the executive officer for 69 out of 142 individual farming operations that have failed to update their enrollment information by submitting an ENOI. Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program staff has determined that these 69 individual farming operations are no longer in business and should be terminated from coverage from the 2012 agricultural order. Yeah. For the remaining operations that Water Board staff has determined are still in operation but have failed to submit an electronic notice of intent, Water Board staff will be prioritizing and following up as necessary. As previously requested by the board, a summary of compliance table has been created. This table will be updated as past due reporting deadlines are evaluated and will be provided annually to the board. In general, the initial levels of compliance are positive, especially given that the 2012 agricultural order is fairly recent. And currently, staff is prioritizing follow-up on all of these past due requirements as they are evaluated in relation to non-compliance. This is a snapshot of the summary of compliance table that was provided to the board in staff report. In the staff report, it's listed as Table 2, Agriculture Order Summary of Compliance. This table demonstrates not only the positive compliance, but also in some cases, increasing compliance. For example, the first requirement listed on this table is the requirement that growers enroll by submitting an electronic notice of intent. This requirement has seen a 2% increase from the previous year. In 2012, 94% had submitted an electronic notice of intent, and as of October of 2013, there is now a 96% compliance rate. Likewise, the requirement that Tier 2 and Tier 3 farms submit an annual compliance form, which is listed on the last line of the summary of compliance table, has also seen a 2% increase from the previous year. In 2012, it had a 75% compliance rate, and as of October of this year, there is now a 77% compliance rate. Again, as stated previously, Water Board staff will be updating the summary of compliance table and will be providing it to the board on an annual basis. Additionally, Water Board staff will be utilizing the information in this compliance table to prioritize follow-up actions related to areas of noncompliance. One of the requirements that was listed on the summary of compliance table, currently as pending evaluation, is the individual groundwater monitoring and reporting requirement. Staff is currently evaluating compliance, as growers are still currently submitting groundwater data, and we will be prioritizing follow-up actions for areas of noncompliance. However, since 2012, labs have been continuously uploading groundwater monitoring data on behalf of growers that have elected to conduct individual groundwater monitoring and reporting. As of October, 2,317 groundwater samples have been submitted. 880 individual farms have reported analytical results for 1,289 groundwater wells, of which 396 groundwater wells provide domestic drinking water. It is also important to note that all of this groundwater monitoring data has been successfully reported in GeoTracker. In the next scheduled item, item 18, the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition will be providing an update on the status of the cooperative groundwater monitoring and reporting program. As indicated on the previous slide, approximately 400 domestic water supply wells have uploaded groundwater monitoring data into GeoTracker. Those wells, in instances where they have exceeded the drinking water standard for nitrate or nitrogen, receive a drinking water notification letter. To date, 47 drinking water notification letters have been issued to both operators and landowners. The two purposes of these letters is first to ensure that both the operators and the landowners are aware of the well exceedance in regards to nitrate or nitrogen. The second goal is to ensure that all the well users are aware of the health risk associated with this water. Again, in the next scheduled item, item 18, the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition can also provide an update to the board on how they will notify their members when there is a domestic water supply well exceedance for nitrate or nitrogen. During the October board meeting, Water Board staff provided an update to the board regarding the recently issued State Water Resource Control Board order that existed that modified the existing agricultural order. Also during that October board meeting, board members requested a summary of these modifications. In response, Water Board staff has created a summary of modifications table that is available in the staff report and is listed as Table 3. Water Board staff would be happy to answer any questions that the board may have in regards to any of these modifications at the end of this presentation. As indicated in the State Water Resource Control Board order, as well as outlined on the summary of modifications table, modifications were required to be made to the annual compliance form. And just as a reminder, the annual compliance form is required to be submitted for all Tier 2 and Tier 3 farms. Water Board staff has completed these modifications to the form, and the form in its modified state was available to growers on October 22nd of this year. In general, the following sections were modified. Section B, irrigation water, now requires that growers report the average nitrogen concentration of their irrigation water, whereas previously they were required to report the maximum nitrate concentration of their irrigation water. Additionally, for Section B irrigation water, growers are now required to calculate or estimate their nitrogen load from the total irrigation water applied. Tier 2 and Tier 3 farms are required to report Section B irrigation water by October 1st of 2014. Modifications were also made to Section C, the groundwater nitrate loading risk determination, and I will provide an overview of those modifications on the next slide. Section H, Water Quality Management Practices, also received minor modifications where optional reporting language was removed. Growers are now required to report on all information related to their water quality management practices. Information such as practice implementation, practice assessment, and practice outcomes. This slide is a snapshot of the currently existing and modified groundwater nitrate loading risk determination in the annual compliance form. This nitrate loading risk determination section provides growers with the opportunity to input their risk information, such as their crop type, irrigation type, soil type, and irrigation water nitrate concentration to help them determine their groundwater nitrate loading risk. Water Board staff has provided detailed instructions and information, such as a list of all the drop-down menu selections and a sample interactive form that growers can use prior to completing and submitting this information online. These grower resource documents, the instructions and information, are available on the annual compliance form in GeoTracker, as well as on our Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program website, and of course are available upon request. Overall, the general feedback from both growers as well as technical assistance providers has been positive, and Water Board staff has not been alerted to any significant issues with growers reporting their groundwater nitrate loading risk. In fact, many growers have already submitted information in this section, and I personally have received a few phone calls from growers where they stated it was quite easy for them to submit this information. Tier 2 and Tier 3 farms are required to submit the Section C groundwater nitrate loading risk determination by January 15th of 2014. In summary, enrollment is increasing in the agricultural order. Compliance is positive and increasing, and Water Board staff will be updating the board on an annual basis regarding compliance. Drinking water notification letters are being issued as necessary in response to the groundwater monitoring data that is reported into GeoTracker. Annual compliance form modifications are complete, and growers are currently submitting information. And lastly, the next routine board update for the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program will be January of 2014. And we'd be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Any board questions?
Mr. Delgado? Very brief one, thank you. That last slide said January 2014 after saying that we'd hear annually. So will there be, what's the difference?
Annually was in regards to the summary of compliance table. Mm-hmm. However, I believe the board has still requested that the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program come to the board at every meeting for updates.
Monthly. Thank you.
Mr. Jordan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions, and one would be on when you're notifying well operators. You use the word ensure a couple times, so what's the method that we actually ensure that they receive that notification?
So once we get NXTDENS and GeoTracker, we have a letter that goes out to the operator that's enrolled, as well as all the landowners that are listed on that property, to ensure that they are alerted to the exceedance. So the lab, I'm not sure if they have reviewed their lab results or are aware that the concentration in their well water exceeds the drinking water standard. So the notification letter informs them of that.
So is that with a proof of delivery or?
Well, it's just we mail a letter, standard letter. It's not mailed a special way.
So how do you ensure that they actually receive it?
Well, we're using, I guess, by the act of mailing it, we haven't actually followed up to ensure that they. So actually, let me rephrase that. We do ask them to provide us with a response. And for those 47, for example, I think we have responses back from 45.
So if you didn't get a response, you then say, I'm not insuring and I need to go insure.
Right. Okay. So what we ask them to do is to provide us a response that they've notified the user and posted it as a non-potable drinking water supply, as well as to provide us with information of any alternative treatment that they may be conducting.
Okay. Then I had a question on the the gap in the registrations versus the ones that you're going to toss off the list versus what's still out there. And it's more of an enforcement question, so it might go to Harvey. But I talked about this, I think, a couple times over the past couple years as dates began stretching out and compliance became eroding from certain perspectives. And I think I mentioned a couple times that as you begin to whether welcome people into this process or push them into this if they don't want to go, what are the consequences on the back end when you actually get a person who just doesn't do it and is found to still be in operation eventually when you catch them? And are those then going to be more draconian consequences than they would be normally before this whole process started? And I'm just wondering what the where that kind of thought is.
This is Harvey Packard. We're talking about a small subset, a distinct group, actually, of people who they enrolled, but then they failed. Correct me if I'm wrong, but then they failed to update their enrollment by submitting the EONOI. So how many are we talking about, 40 or 50?
If we terminate the 69 right. We've recommended, we'd have 73 left.
73 left. So the question we grapple with is how much effort do we spend going after these 73 versus other aspects of noncompliance in the program? Not only this program, but all the programs that the enforcement staff has to deal with. So I don't have an answer for you right now on that, but that's the question that raises.
I guess I'm making a comment then that it'd be a shame if those 70 people are actually in operation and just kind of openly ignoring the process and walk away from it when we both lured and prodded others into getting into the process and being good citizens about it.
Right, I agree.
Okay.
Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. Let me follow on to that. Is there work with the ag associations in being more aggressive or taking on another phase of outreach to those 70 so that it's coming directly from within the ag community itself? Is that a part of the communication that's going on?
I think I'd have to refer that to Angela.
Angela Schroeder. So the answer is yes, and the ag groups are really doing that very proactively. I think you might even hear some comments today of the various commissions and associations are following up. For example, we got several calls from folks who thought that they were on the list, and it was by mentioning of from other ag reps. And the Strawberry Commission, for example, is trying to ensure that their members are enrolled. So there's a lot of proactive outreach going on.
Yeah, and I mean that makes total sense. That it's going to take for that last group, it's going to take more effort. But I think coming from within the community is also a feature of all the resources that we have available to do this. So really quickly, I have one correction in the report on page 8. Second to last box, provision 69. I think you just are missing first line says for Tier 2 and Tier 3. I'm sure the 3 is missing there. So just if you wanted to make that correction. And then I have a question regarding the ongoing presentations, and I really appreciate Ken Harris's constant updating us on just how active staff is in continuing with outreach. And I noticed that Monica Baracate is doing many of these, and I'm curious to know the nature of these. How do they appear relative to where we are in our program? Are you going out with a kind of a uniform message, or are you tailoring the message to the individual groups in these regions, or how is that outreach being done? and design?
I'll let Monica speak for herself. However, I think they are being tailored. And so with respect to both what the upcoming requirement is as well as the priority related to the forum. So, for example, Monica recently has been spending lots of time focusing on nitrate loading risk, nutrient management, because those are all the requirements that are now moving forward. Mm-hmm. Also, Monica happens to be a certified crop advisor, so she has a lot of expertise in being able to provide that level of technical input.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the board. I am Monica Barricarte with the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. And to answer your question, in general, my presentations cover general information about the water quality conditions. And depending on the area where I'm presenting, I'm focusing more on the conditions for Salinas rather than Santa Maria, for example. Mm-hmm. Also, on the nature of the the conference itself, if it's more focusing on fertilizers management than pesticide management, then I make minor changes on my presentation, as well as the audience or the growers that are attending the conferences. If they are conventional growers, I focus on conventional impairments related to conventional use of pesticides, or if we are organic growers, are focus more on nitrogen application because organic growers have a potential to impair groundwater because they still apply nitrogen. So is that answering your question?
Yes, absolutely, because we've worked so hard to move beyond one size fits all, and so I'm trying to see how different elements of the program reflect what we've learned, what we know, mm-hmm. and the collaboration and the partnering that's been, you know, growing through the process as well. And I think we're recognizing where, you know, how the differences look in each region and speaking to issues that have relevance mm-hmm. in real time is really important, you know. So and I anticipated that that's what you were doing, but I just want to know some of the what it looked like to you. So I appreciate that. And are you feeling that these are productive exchanges? You have a chance to talk with people, get good feedback?
Definitely. They see these conferences as an opportunity for them to ask questions, specific questions about the requirements I'm focusing on and how to answer some of, for example, the questions that are in the annual compliance form and the details that they need to know and how to answer them. So they see these opportunities as a venue for asking direct questions.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Monica's in very high demand.
Yeah, I can imagine, especially being bilingual. I'm sure that's another added benefit.
Any other board questions? Mr. Johnston.
Thank you. I have a couple of different questions. I note that the Tier 2 and 3 growers submitting annual compliance forms for 2013 is listed as 77%. Now, is that relevant to a deadline that's passed?
Yeah, so the deadline to submit annual compliance forms is October 1st of every year.
Okay, so that seems kind of low. I mean, I guess it's higher than last year. Last year was 72%. How can you just give me a sense as to how we're following up on that?
So keep in mind that the order was adopted on March, in 2012. And so we've had one full year for growers to submit, and this is now the second reporting term. So in general ways that we're following up is one is to work with these outreach methods, and going to conferences as well as working with the tech providers and the associations to make sure that there is assistance out there. Secondly, each staff person is assigned specific areas of the region in which they prioritize farms for follow-up. And that, in general, that prioritization has to do with the proximity to the impairments as well as the risk of that, the risk of that particular farm, water quality risk. And so staff is following up with emails, letters, and phone calls to evaluate the compliance and why growers have not submitted their annual compliance form. In general, we are also looking at broader methods. Traditionally, we'd be sending them out a 13267 letter or a notice of violation But that would be a mass, right? So 25% of 4,000 is still a lot of people, a lot of farms. Well,
these are just tier two and
I'm
three,
sorry,
right?
Right. I mean, so that's roughly, what, 2,800 maybe, something like that. But that's still a sizable number. So we're looking at efficient ways to get that out. And so one of the things that we're considering right now is basically like a violation postcard that checks off all the things that you have not yet done, and those go out to the growers in a more automated way. And then we would follow up with that with a more traditional approach using a notice of violation as individual correspondence.
Okay. And given that the Tier 2 and 3 are the higher risk sectors, it would be nice maybe to hear in January sort of what the results are on that and how much that 77% number has changed. Because it concerns me if we're not getting the annual compliance report. The landowners that were, or excuse me, the enrollees that were proposing terminating the 69 on the assumption that they're no longer in business. I know that when they enroll, we have assessor's parcel numbers on them. We know the land that they're farming. Are we cross-checking to see who is farming that so that they're not simply dropping out of the picture?
So we can confirm that some of those that are the 69 recommended for termination have been enrolled under existing AW numbers that are currently enrolled now. And the other ones we can confirm as well that they either are enrolled or they are not enrolled. For those that aren't enrolled, we can follow up. We can prioritize and follow up on ensuring that they enroll in the future.
Okay, but I'm talking about the ones that we're proposing dropping off the list because we believe they've gone out of business. Those enrollees, the land that they were farming, are we taking a cross-checking to see what the parcels were that they were farming, who's farming on it now, and are they enrolled?
We haven't done that actively, but we know for sure that a subset of the 69 are in the system, their land, just because of the follow-up that we did to ensure that those farms were actually no longer in business. So that business person said, so-and-so vineyard is now in place on that farm, and they're enrolled. In general, we have not taken the effort to do a cross-check of verifying that new land is enrolled. But we can definitely do that. It's a pretty low percentage. The acreage is pretty low, so we just haven't prioritized that activity. But we can definitely do that.
So Angela told me that the system retains all the information. So there's from the time back to when data started being put into GeoTracker, there's a complete history on every parcel. That's retained. It's not. So when you're farming parcel X and you leave, that is not thrown out. That information is retained.
Yeah, I mean, it seems it's a relatively small number compared to the overall numbers of growers we're dealing with. And if it's in a database, it seems like it would be a fairly simple matter to say, we're assuming this grower is out of business. They were farming these APNs. We pull these APNs. We see that somebody else is currently enrolled who's farming them. And then we've cross-checked it. And if the land turns out that there's no one enrolled on that land, then maybe we follow up with the landowner.
That's correct, and we can do that.
Okay. Next, the 47 drinking water letters that we've sent out as a result of individual monitoring of drinking water wells that exceed the standards. What's the nature or lack of nature of public access to that information at this point? How does that work?
And Jessica can correct me if I'm wrong, but those notification letters that go out are public record. And in fact, several of them have been requested through a Public Records Act request. And so there's nothing about those letters that would be exempt from public disclosure.
Yes, that's public information.
So presumably somebody could make a blanket Public Records Act request for all such letters that have gone
out.
That's
correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think that's it for this agenda item. To be continued next month. There are two cards, excuse me, Mr. Schmidt and Mr. Schimmick. Do have two speaker cards.
Steve and I are always a tandem.
Yes.
Good afternoon, members of the board. Kirk Schmidt, on behalf of Preservation Inc., we do the cooperative monitoring program on the Central Coast and have since 2005. There are a couple issues in the report that we want support and also would like to have further follow-up on. The growers who are being terminated from the system are pretty consistent with the list that we gave your board over a year ago of growers that we thought should be terminated from the system because they had died, they're in jail, bankrupt, or have no addresses. So we support that. There may be a few in there that we're uncertain about, but most of them we're quite certain of. They're no longer in business. However, there are still the 73 growers that have never completed an ENOI, and many of those 73 growers, well, those 73 growers fall into two categories. Growers that we've billed this last year that were turned over to the state for collections, which I will get to in a moment, and growers in that category who have paid every year since 2005. So some of the growers in the no ENOI category are, in their minds, absolutely participating in the program because they pay our bill every year. What it takes for them to turn on their computer, I have no idea. But I don't recommend that all of those be terminated because they have been paying and they believe they're participating in full. As to some of the growers in the no ENOI list, and indeed as to all the growers who didn't pay this past year, for the first time since 2005, the State Water Board has sent out Tier 3 collection letters so the Tier 3 fee is different from your Tier 3. If you pay the state water, you know, the ag fee through Preservation Inc., in the past year it was 56 cents per acre. In this coming year it's going to be 75 cents per acre. Previously it was you know, 12 cents. If you pay through us, you get that fee. If you don't pay through us, there's a penalty fee that's about 70 times larger. And indeed, the penalty fee is larger than the entire cooperative monitoring program operation fee plus this little tiny tax. So about 300 growers were turned over to the state for collection, or not for collection, for enforcement of the Tier 3 fee. The growers who did not pay the state have then been terminated from the cooperative monitoring program and moved into the individual monitoring program. So while on the chart it shows that there were 46 growers that were signed up for individual monitoring, there has been no enforcement on that. Indeed, there's been no enforcement on that since 2005. There's not a single individual monitoring grower who's had any enforcement on it. Now that list is not 40 anymore, it's 250. Because all the people who were in Tier 3 were moved into that category. So now we have a much greater group of growers who are active growers who are not participating in the cooperative monitoring program, which does impact our fees and our ability to do the monitoring program, and who are in noncompliance with your order in any basis. And so these are not people who are dead or in jail. These are people who are out there farming, and there should be more attention brought to those. There's an issue about that we talked about again last year, and that is that landowners have a very, very difficult time determining if their tenant is enrolled in the program. If you have a good tenant, I have a very good tenant, he tells me he's enrolled in the program, he gives me copies of the stuff, that's great. But many tenants are not that diligent, and it's virtually impossible to determine from the system whether you call us because we have copies of the database, or whether you call your staff, because there's really no way to index through the assessor parcel number. And we talked about this, Mr. Jordan, I think a year ago, we thought that there should be some way to track this. That has not occurred, and it's really difficult now, particularly important with the groundwater aspect of this, because there's, again, no way to determine whether your tenant has submitted the groundwater reporting or participating in the cooperative groundwater program. Lastly, the cooperative monitoring program requires Preservation Inc. to submit data originally to CCAMP quarterly, and now to Sedan. In 7.5 years, we have never missed a deadline except once. This year, the deadline was the end of September, and Sarah Lopez, who has done the work for us for many years, had a baby a week early, and she missed the deadline. We gave notice to staff that this was a possibility to find it in the staff report that we missed this deadline as though we have dropped the ball, I think is a little curious. But more importantly, the upload to CEDIN is problematic. We upload about 500,000 individual cells of data quarterly to CEDIN on one upload. Of that, 10,000 come back with errors every quarter. The reason they come back with errors is because CEDIN has not input into their lookup table our site locations and the specific identification numbers for our equipment. And because they have not done this, all the site locations, which is all the locations, and all the equipment comes back as an error. There's 10,000 errors we have no control over. There's 87 unique errors. Of the 87 unique errors in the last quarterly upload, 7 were attributed to us. Now, it's not unusual with a large database to have some errors at the time you upload. But so since this has gone to CEDIN a year and a half ago, we have not had a successful upload. And we've never had a successful upload with this system. We have been giving the data directly to your staff, and we enjoy working closely with your staff on this problem. And it's not something that your staff has an issue with. And it's indeed, we've worked closely with CEDIN on this issue, but they haven't changed this so that we are successful in having these uploads. So while it was regrettable that Sarah had her baby a week early and didn't meet the deadline, I think it's much more important that CEDIN address this issue so we can successfully upload this, because without uploading this, it's not going to be available on your CCAMP website. Thank you very much.
Mr. Harris, any reaction to what we just heard?
Well, actually, I was going to ask Angela. I'm not aware. Can you tell us what's going on, or maybe?
Oh, I can respond to a few of Mr. Schmidt's comments, and then I'll let Karen Worcester talk about the CEDIN issue. I'm not aware of the capacity issues with CEDIN. So regarding the enforcement on individual monitoring, we have actually conducted enforcement. We have issued 13267 letters. Those growers have received notices of violation. And now Harvey and I are coordinating on what more appropriate follow-up is warranted on that. However, it is, I think, worth noting now that since those growers are going to getting the state board's increased permit fee because they're not in the cooperative, it's a pretty serious consequence to have your invoice go to collections, right? So that's part of the follow-up, I think, that's the context that we should remember. Regarding the issue about landowners not sure their properties enrolled, we absolutely agree. That's a very big problem. It's really important for landowners to have full transparency and understand whether or not their land is enrolled. And actually, Mr. Schmidt's comment is the main reason why we've been working with GeoTracker to get those farm locations online, so that a grower or a landowner or any other interested party can go online and see a farm location in its location and understand which operations are enrolled and if that's on their property. So that's something that we have already requested that State Board do, and that we anticipate will be done early next year, hopefully. The groundwater reporting, similarly, we hope to, as soon as we can integrate the reporting with the cooperative, there will be a way for landowners to verify either through GeoTracker or a different reporting which operations have complied with that requirement. We know landowners are highly interested in that as well. And then I'll let Karen talk about CEDIN. I'm not sure what the issues are there.
Karen Worcester, Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. And Kirk's pretty accurate. It's the problems we've been having with CEDIN in terms of getting error-free uploads. And it does appear that one of the big hang-ups is that they aren't updating their lookup tables in a timely fashion, so when there's new information in the file, they can relate it to the table. And Mary Hamilton of CCAMP staff made extremely pointed comments about this problem at the Swamp Roundtable earlier this month to Karen Larson, who's the director of Office of Information Management and Assessment, and also Rich Brewer, who's immediately under her. And I think it was new information to Rich Brewer, so I think that was good. She was very clear about the problem, and hopefully we'll get some more movement on it. It's been a little frustrating because we've managed our data well over the years, and sometimes I feel like because of that, they assume that we can handle it, and they give other groups more attention. That's a personal opinion. But we've had a little bit of trouble with our own data as well, getting it to move through the system and into the CDN website and database. So we're working on it. We've been working at sort of at the staff level, but I think with Mary's recent comments, we've elevated it quite a bit. So hopefully we'll see some movement on that.
Thank you, Karen. You know, Angela, but I think I don't know if I heard a response to something Kurt said, and that was there's a group of growers that are actively growing, but we seem to think that they may not be active.
Well, there's a group of growers who have failed to submit the ENOI, right?
Okay.
So, and they are actually paying their bill to Kirk, right?
Okay.
But just not complying with the Water Board requirements. Elaine has been talking with Kirk's staff, and so the one of the things we're trying to confirm is to make sure that the information that Kirk has about them, the business contact information, that they're clearly able to receive invoices from Preservation Inc., is the same as that we have, so that we can make sure that we're communicating with them directly. But that's a clear violation that we can follow up on, and especially if Kirk has the information to contact them.
Okay. Dr. Wolf?
See, Angela, wasn't the intent to send a postcard to the landowners, and that was to prevent misunderstanding between the operators and the landowner, and that the postcard was going to clearly highlight the fact that it was their ultimate responsibility to, because it's their property?
That's correct. And those postcards, I believe, I asked our admin staff, I think they are being mailed out either today or on Monday. We issued, you know, there's thousands of them, so we had to use our Office of Statewide Printing, so they're being mailed out of Sacramento. But that's exactly correct. So all landowners of property that's enrolled in the agricultural order will receive a postcard that clearly identifies the landowner and the operator as responsible for complying with requirements, including the monitoring and reporting.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Johnston.
Two questions. First of all, you know, you were talking about doing a postcard to the operators that has a checkbox that these are the things that you have and haven't complied with. I'm wondering if it would be practical to use the same system with the landowners for them to simply get, based on the owner of the APN, a postcard saying this is what the operator has and has not complied with, and you're ultimately responsible as well. That's the first thing, just something, a suggestion to take into consideration. And the second thing is the question of that Kirk raised of the 300 plus people now who are on individual monitoring because they've either never signed up for cooperative monitoring in the first place or didn't pay their bills. You mentioned that we've issued notice of violation letters. Is that to the how many of those have we issued? Is that to that whole group or to a subset of them?
It's a subset because some of those are more recent. So some of those have just now not paid Kirk and are having to pay the state permit fee, and so it would be they're complying as an individual.
So it's the 70-some, not the 250-some?
Right. So I think it's more than 70-something, but the most recent ones that were just pushed into individual for failure to pay fees, those have not received notices of violation
yet.
But
they're in the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay.
I have one comment, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment that staff actively, as we come across these issues, actively works on solutions to solve them. The best example, I think, was the sending deadbeat people to collections at the state board, and that was a solution that staff working with state board came up with. We were trying to figure out a way to, and I think it was in direct response to a comment that Mr. Jordan had made a while back about what, you know, can you go after these guys and get them to collect or whatever, and it was a solution that staff developed to solve that problem once and for all. So it's a lot like, if you've ever heard the story about NASA and JPL, when they fly unmanned missions to the stars, they don't even try to debug all the software because there are millions and millions of lines of software, and they said if we tried to debug the whole program, we'd never fly a mission. So what they do is they go ahead and launch it, and then some of those bugs are going to appear and be a problem, and they will solve those on the fly. Others never show up, and it's never an issue. So, I mean, the ag program and a lot of programs are similar. So we've got this ag program launched, and as we come across these issues that we could not possibly anticipate, staff and working with the coalitions and the growers and others are actively looking for solutions. So I don't want you to get the impression that we aren't actively working on these.
Through the chair, could I follow up briefly?
Yes, go ahead.
Ken, you just mentioned that we couldn't have anticipated them, but one thing Mr. Schmidt said was that since 2010, the CD problem hasn't been fixed. So that seems to be something we might have anticipated.
The seeding problem?
The problem with the upload errors.
Yeah, I think Karen, do you want to answer that?
It's the last year and a half.
Last year.
Okay. Well, we've also been going through a change in terms of use of seeding too, isn't that right? We weren't always using seeding, and if Karen wants to come up, and the whole state, the whole water board data system is going through an evolution right now in terms of how we collect and disseminate data. So we're not doing this in isolation. We're part of the state board, 9 regional boards, and other things that are trying to fit data into this system that has multiple purposes. For example, the 303D list, a lot of the data that we use to develop that list comes from CEDIN. So this is not in isolation.
We developed a data delivery system when the program started that worked pretty well for a number of years. And it worked well enough that CDEN got a grant, a $500,000 grant, and took our software and adapted it for their own purposes. And that's, you know, it's morphed quite a bit. And that's the system that we're talking about. So we did manage the data ourselves for quite some time. And, you know, we had our own issues, but I think overall we did pretty well. So the issue they're having, it has a lot to do with, first of all, they did a lot of changes to it, so they had a lot of, you know, bumps in the road, as well as this maintenance issue that you really need to have staff there that can work hand in hand with each of the deliverers and update their lookup lists and make sure that their individual issues are addressed in a timely fashion, and it's the timely fashion thing we're really having trouble with, and it may be not enough staffing for the program they're trying to manage.
Thank you. Okay.
A couple comments I wanted to mention before you close the staff part of this item.
Okay. Well, we have Mr. Schimmer next, but go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to mention that at the last meeting we mentioned that we have a new staff person, Arwen Wyatt Mayer, who had joined our staff. But I also wanted to mention recently that Corey Walsh, who is sitting there in the third row, is also transferred to the Agricultural Regulatory Program. He previously was an engineering geologist with the Underground Storage Tank Program, so just wanted to let you know that Corey is now on the Ag team, and we're happy to have his expertise. So.
Good. Mr. Schimmick.
Steve Schimmick, the Otter Project in Monterey Coast Keeper. Just a question. Could you break down for me how many Tier 1, 2, and 3 growers we have in the program? So.
Let's see. I don't know if you have those numbers right here in our hand. Do you have those available?
See, I don't think it's split out.
I have a number for the total Tier 2 and Tier 3 farms that are lumped together, but I don't have them separated out here in front of me.
So here's the issue. I remember probably 3 or 4 or 5 months ago, you know, the board asked if there was anything that the public wanted to hear about. And I came forward and I said, specifically, I'm concerned about the number of Tier 3 farms and where they're located, because I think it's different than, or we've sort of kind of heard that it's different from what was anticipated, that there were 106 farms or 109 that were originally anticipated to be in Tier 3. And it's my understanding that number is maybe quite a bit, on an order of 40% less. That would mean that we are monitoring the discharges of approximately 1% of all the farms. That would concern me. And so I asked for this, I think, 4 or 5 months ago. I would like that information. How many Tier 1, how many Tier 2, and how many Tier 3 farms do we have? And if there is a difference between the number anticipated and the number that are actually enrolled, why? Thank you.
Mr. Shimmick, why don't you give Angela a call next week, unless you have the information now?
We do have some approximate numbers.
Great.
Tier 3, there's approximately 60 farms.
Right.
Tier 2, approximately 1,700. And Tier 1, approximately 2,400 farms.
So that would be the shortfall that I'm really interested in. And I'm also very interested in where those 60 are, because and the reason that I'm interested in that is because I think that when we kind of sat down and when we were envisioning this program, we all saw the red blotches of the areas of greatest concern in the lower Salinas and lower Santa Maria valleys. And what we wanted was to make sure that the program was focusing on those high priority red splotches. And so the distribution of where those Tier 3 farms are, I think, is really important. And so it's the number and it's where they're at that it would be great to have.
Well, I'm sure if you follow up Monday with Angela, they'll give you the information.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else, you guys, on this agenda item? Okay, we'll move on.
Excuse me. I'm not familiar with the term seed. Just how do you spell it?
Either am I.
It's the California Information Data Network Exchange, something like that.
Wow.
California Environmental Data Exchange Network.
Okay.
How do you spell seed?
CEDEN.
Thank you.
Another abbreviation.
Thank you.
I feel bad because this is the first time I think I've heard.
Just for history, it actually had its origins with the Department of Water Resources and we, or the Natural Resource Agency, and we actually took it over.